Let's go.
Oh, no.
Do you
want to
start? I'll let you.
I'm excited and I feel relaxed and I'm ready to party!
Let's say sorry.
You don't need to do that. You don't need to apologize. It's a fucked up female habit. You don't need to be sorry for anything ever.
Can you guess what every woman's worst nightmare is?
I don't have rage issues!
I have nothing to prove to you.
When I'm good, I'm very good. But when I'm bad, I'm better.
I say when it comes to stardom and Lauren, there are no accidents.
Hi, Karen Peterson.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Citizen Dame, the podcast where we are raunchy ladies talking about raunchy ladies. I was going to try to do that with a straight face, and then I couldn't. I am Lauren Humphreys-Brooks, and with me, as always, is raunchy lady Karen Peterson. I'm sorry.
Hello.
Jeez. I apologize. It was an intro. I cracked myself up. Awesome. How are you, Karen?
I'm doing all right. How are you?
I'm pretty good.
I'm still recovering from last night. I'm just going to brag a little. I got to go listen to Mahler's Fifth last night, which anybody who has seen Tar, which should be everybody listening to this show, would recognize as a very significant piece in the Cate Blanchett starring film Tar from last year. I guess technically not last year, the year before now, but yeah.
But was Lydia Tarr like conducting? I mean,
you know, my friend and I kept hoping that she would just come out and just push that guest conductor off the stage and say, no, this is mine, but she never did.
Damn. Yeah. Well, she's been kind of, she's sort of canceled, unfortunately.
Yeah, she definitely was canceled. Yeah. Not for no good reason.
Yeah, no, perfectly good reasons. Like I don't, I'm not defending her at all.
anyway, it was great. So
that's awesome. That's awesome. That's very, I think I saw last time. That's very artistic of you. Very like artistic integrity here. Like me, I drank too much wine and watched a Japanese film. So
which also sounds like a really great night.
It was a lot of fun. Had a good time. So today we are actually, one of the things that we want to talk about is raunchy lady comedies. I didn't know what else to call this, like raunchy comedies starring women. It's, again, it's kind of clunky to say, so that's the raunchy ladies. But it's kind of a specific subgenre, but the subgenre of films that, usually feature like some big event for a group of women who get to go out and do shenanigans and like get into all kinds of trouble and possibly break multiple laws, international ones, national ones. And also it's just a chance to, you know, very often watch some really good female comedians interacting with each other and having a lot of fun together. So the three films that we're going to talk about today are Bridesmaids, from 2011, which in many ways is one of the OG raunchy lady comedies, definitely from this era. We're also going to talk about Joyride, which came out in 2023, and I think is a very good kind of corollary to Bridesmaids. And then finally, Bottoms, which also came out in 2023, which is sort of the odd one out on this one, but is kind of a different approach to these stories that are very much about female relationships and really highlighting in a lot of ways one of the many ways that women actually relate to each other and talk to each other in a more satirical way, I think, than Bridesmaids or Joyride does. But before we get going, Karen, why don't we talk about the brief history of the subgenre? So you were saying that it was kind of that the subgenre sort of started in the late 70s. Where do you think this starts?
Yeah, I would say just raunchy comedies in general, kind mm-hmm. of. You can tie those back to the late 70s with films like Animal House and going into the 80s. Yeah. You have Bachelor Party with Tom Hanks and Risky Business and Losing It, a couple of early Tom Cruise movies. So you really start to see just those raunchy sex comedies emerge in this time yeah. period. There were a few that existed earlier in the 70s, but really prior to the 1970s, this was something that didn't really make it to mainstream film. And it's just grown, I think, from there. But as far as women's roles in these types of films, mm-hmm. it's really limited with the exception of Amy Heckerling's Fast Times at Ridgemont High, which we talked about on this podcast, I think, last year. Other than that, mostly women's roles in raunchy comedies were to be the object of the men's, you know, fantasy and sort of their goal.
Yeah.
You mentioned in your intro that, especially with the three films we're talking about today, there's sort of this goal that brings women together in films that are female led, but, for men, it's usually this sort of more of a conquest type of thing. They have a goal, and it's usually got a woman attached to that goal. But you start to see a little bit more of women having those central roles as you get into the late 90s, early 2000s. But it really is Bridesmaids in 2011 that makes it sort of this acceptable subgenre, where now women, stories of women leading their own, and whether mm-hmm. men are involved in those stories or not is really irrelevant to the existence of this kind of group of films. And so it's fun to see that progression and see where we are now and how far we've come, and how women get to just kind of own this themselves and have mm-hmm. movies that are very much for women, mostly by women, although there are some notable exceptions. you still have men making these same comedies, but you really do see kind of this divide of what separates men's raunchy comedies from women's, you know. And
yeah.
And I think a lot of it does come down to some of the things that we're going to talk about today, about, you know, the types of friendships that you're looking at and the ways that they communicate with each other and what their goals are for these types of event. I feel like they're kind of event movies in some ways too. And so,
That's a good description where you've got, like, you know, a wedding coming up or a birthday, or, like, you know, so that reason for these women to get together. Right. Mm-hmm. And then they become like, okay, so now we're going to go on a trip, right? We're going to go we're going to do something. We're going to do all these things that are very, and it's very specific often to women, this whole idea about a girl's trip, right?
Right.
Where you sort of leave all of the shackles behind and you go off and you do some crazy shit. And it's always extreme, right? It's very, very rarely is this, it's something that most people actually get up to on a regular basis. You know, very often they go to someplace like Vegas, stuff like that. It's like everything, you know, everything goes in Vegas. Whenever what I think about
in Vegas stays in Vegas.
Yeah, exactly. But just to go back really quickly to this whole issue of sex comedies. I do think, you know, even before the 70s, I think the sex comedy really began to become more prevalent in like the 50s. But it was a very different type of comedy. Like, it's not this kind of, a lot of what we're talking about are like the raunchy, you know, Fast Times at Ridgemont High kind of thing, where it's a...
just let it all out, say what you're thinking. Yeah.
And there's very often not a single central character who drives the entire thing. It's a group of people.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes in the case of Fast Times at Ridgemont High, you know, you've got a lot of different stories all going at once. There isn't a single middle story. The middle story is getting to the end of high school, basically. But sex comedies, you know, start popping up really in the 1950s. So when all of kind of the studio strictures are relaxing, when there's a big shift in American culture, and people are getting more, you know, relaxed about depicting sexuality, about depicting all different kinds of sexuality. But one of the things I always find interesting about the sex comedies is that they often feel very reactionary, because of this sort of, it's still this drive towards, you know, you're making jokes about sex, you're making light of it in some way, but it's still this drive towards having the single heteronormative relationship, the guy getting the girl in the end, that kind of thing. And so, like, some of the most reactionary films, you know, some of the, like, Doris Day, Rock Hudson movies, right? Which are sex comedies, are very much like, you know, playing with this idea of sex outside of marriage, but then ultimately, but everybody has to get married and have this really tight, closed system, right? And I think that that carries through to a lot of the raunchy comedies of like the 70s and 80s, where there is this sensation of like, I get very uncomfortable with a lot of them, because there is a sensation of like, you know, the woman is the thing that you obtain. It's the reward for the dorky guy. And I mean, and different films deal with it differently. I think something like Fast Times at Ridgemont High does better with it in a lot of ways, as does to a certain degree Animal House. But then you've also got stuff like, you know, Revenge of the Nerds, which is deeply uncomfortable to watch as a woman. But it is very much in keeping with, you know, that the entire trajectory of these kinds of films. So when you get finally to something like Bridesmaids, it is this like breath of fresh air, because you're centralizing the female characters. You're saying that, you know, the women have lives and problems. And also the thing that I love, and so let's just get into Bridesmaids. The thing that I love about Bridesmaids is that it was one of the first films that I saw. It's just like, that is actually how women talk to each other. That is the shit that women say. And it doesn't, it never feels to me like it's just gender flipping. This is actually like, no, this is how women relate. As crazy as it is in places, this is actually very accurate, including like all of the swearing and the gross stuff, like all that. This it's actually like, yes, this is what women are like. You want to know what women are like? This is it.
Yeah. I remember when this came out. Obviously, you know, most of us remember when this came out, but it was billed as sort of the female version of The Hangover. And
yeah,
you know, I mean, there's a central part where these women are heading off to a bachelorette party in Vegas, and which is kind of what the entire movie of The Hangover is about. It's a bachelor party in Vegas gone wrong. And so it was built that way, I think, to I'm not exactly sure why, other than people just didn't really know how to classify the film and marketing it. Yeah. But when I saw it, I was actually, it's funny because I was in Vegas with one of my best friends and we had some time and we're like, let's go see Bridesmaids. It was just out that weekend. So we watched Bridesmaids in Vegas and we loved it instantly, but we both were like, this is not at all like The Hangover. And we're so glad about that. Like it got to be its own thing. It was very much its own film that, like you said, it really does capture the experience of female friendships and the way that we talk to each other, whether we're friends or whether we're not friends. And it captures those nuances just so well. And also the awkwardness of hanging out with people you don't know very well and you're supposed to all get along and you're there for the same reason. But it's the awkwardness that comes from that too.
Yeah.
And it's just, it's so well done. I just also want to mention, because I'm the stats girl and I love the Oscars, this was nominated for 2 Academy Awards, by the way, for original screenplay by Annie Mamolo and Kristen Wiig, and also Melissa McCarthy for supporting actress.
Mm-hmm. Well, and this is like, I mean, well, let's talk about Melissa McCarthy in a minute, because she really is just a force in this.
Oh, film. Yeah.
In a film full of forces, like, yes. Honestly. but so this is directed by Paul Feig, as we know, and Paul Feig, we're forgiving him for being male in this case. He is allowed to direct this film. He is an honorary woman, so this is all right. He's really a female director. but it's also written by Kristen Wiig and Annie Mumolo, which is very important, I think. In fact, all three of the films that we're talking about were written by women. Yeah. And I think that is important, it just in terms of exactly what we're talking about here, is that the way that women relate to each other, the things that women actually say, the jokes that you make with your friends, and beyond that, the female relationships themselves, that, so, you know, and the big conflict is very much Annie, played by Kristen Wiig, and Oh, now I'm blanking on her name.
Helen Harris the Third.
Helen, yeah. And you and as soon as she comes on screen, you're like, I know what this is.
Yep.
Like I've and it's not one of those like, oh, she's a character type. She has all of them are types to a certain degree, right? But so I know that person. I have met that person. Maybe not that specific character, but I know what this dynamic looks like.
Mm-hmm.
You know, even if you haven't been directly involved with it, you've watched it happen, right? Mm-hmm. And so you know, like, and the way that they relate to each other and the attempts to kind of be nice, but also the passive aggression and like the one-upsmanship, all of that stuff is so true to like reality that it's painful. And play, there are places where I'm just like, I can't actually look at this. I can't listen. Yeah. I can't watch this because it's so, it is actually real. And I think that that runs through the entire film where the way that the women relate to each other, both in terms of the comedy, but also just in terms of the interpersonal relationships is so real.
Right, because it really taps into something that is very, I know men experience this as well, but women sometimes a little too often, actually way too often, are crippled by feelings of inadequacy and mm-hmm. feel imposter syndrome, you know, all those things are so true to our experience. And what Bridesmaids captures so well is two women who are at complete opposite ends of the socioeconomic scale.
Yeah.
Who, because you've got Annie, who is basically, I mean, at a certain point in the movie, she hits rock bottom where she has no money. She has no, nothing. Nothing is hers. And she gets invited to not live in her own apartment anymore. And she has to go move back in with her mom in her 30s. And then you've got on the opposite end of that, you've got Helen, who is married to a very successful businessman. They're very wealthy. She has a country club membership. But what Helen doesn't have is a group of female friends. She does not have a best friend. And so she latches onto Lillian, who is this person that connects all of them together, which is Maya Rudolph. And she's the bride. And I hope people have seen the movie that are listening to this, but just, you know, just in case you haven't. Or it's been a while. Anyway, so they're basically like, so you got Annie and Helen are basically fighting over Lillian, and she's the thing that brings them together. But they would never have any reason to ever interact mm-hmm. If it wasn't for this event, essentially. And but even though they come from two completely different worlds, and you know, Annie would totally, you know, just envy so much of what Helen has. What Annie eventually needs to understand is that she has things that Helen can't just buy with her money. And so just seeing the way that dynamic plays out, mm-hmm. it's done so well because it's something that any woman can relate to, no matter which end of that economic scale you're on, no matter where you're at in your life. I think it's something that we all can relate to in some way.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm glad that you brought up the whole class question, because that was one of the things that I guess never completely clicked for me when I first saw the film. And that actually on this rewatch, I was like, this is really about class. Mm-hmm. Because yeah, exactly. So much. So you have Lillian and Annie who come from, you know, they come from the same place. They've been friends since they were kids, all of this stuff. And then you've got Helen, who, like you say, is on the completely other end of the spectrum. And Lillian is connecting to her based on her job and her, you know, the man that she's marrying, et cetera. So there is this like trajectory of connection, right? And what is happening is that Annie feels like she's getting left behind. But there are all of those moments where, like, you know, even the bridesmaid dress fitting, right, which is mm-hmm. so funny and gets overshadowed by the food poisoning attacking yes. everybody. But one of the elements that is working there is the fact that Annie can't afford any of this.
Right.
She's looking at the cost of dresses. She's looking at the cost of everything. And she's like, I can't pay for this. Right. I can't, you know, and I think that many of us, but certainly myself, have had that experience of like, I can't, I don't have the money for that. I don't have the money to do this. Right. And it's that pressure to be like, but I want to be there for my friend. I want to do all of these things, but I literally can't. And so you've got this kind of pushing and pulling going on, and her feeling like she's being frozen out, her ideas aren't being listened to, et cetera. Meanwhile, you get Helen, and what we learn about Helen is that she does have all of this money, she's beautiful, she gets all of this attention, but she has a very empty life. She's unhappy. And that's, I think, where, you know, the film does such a good job at not focusing on the romantic relationships for the most part. It's so you've got all these women, all of whom are married. We meet most of their husbands. Most of the husbands we meet only briefly, like they are kind of there and then they're gone, and we get little glimpses of them. But the real importance is these interpersonal relationships between the women. And one of the things that Helen is missing is that she doesn't have any friends. She doesn't have anyone that is for her that she feels connected to. And she's found that to a degree with Lillian, and Annie threatens that. So the entire story really is about this building jealousy and confusion and sense that you're losing someone, or that someone is trying to take, you know, your friend away from you. And it's treated in with the same weight and the same complexity as we often do in like more standard romantic comedies, right? There's never this indication that, you know, oh, Annie is actually in love with Lillian or anything like that, but there's a sense of like these relationships are incredibly important. It's not you go off and get married and that's your only life. You might go off and get married or you might not, but the women that you are friends with, the people that you are close to, are incredibly important.
Right. Well, and so there's a couple of things just to mention here. I think one is, for Helen, she's not just someone who doesn't have a lot of, she mentions at one point, I just don't have many female friends. And it's like, okay, that's not accurate. You really don't have any friends. And also her husband doesn't even spend time with her. He's constantly gone.
Yeah.
Her stepkids can't stand her. They openly like are terrible to her. And who knows what she's like to them, because we only see, you know, one real scene with them. But so she's an extremely lonely person. And that, for someone who has a lot of money and is used to being able to just buy things and probably buy people, she sees this opportunity in Lillian. I'm just going to adopt this woman as my own. You know, I'm going to just make her be my best friend, and that's fine. But then Annie comes along, and she's heard probably so much about Annie, because Annie is so important to Lillian. They grew up together. They've known each other since they were tiny, tiny children. And so she sees Annie as this threat. So when Annie comes into the picture, it's very, you know, she's talking down to her. Oh, you're so cute. You're so sweet. You know, like trying to separate. I am this glamorous woman and you are this little girl, even though they're all grown adults who, and, you know, but it's very much trying to further establish this separation or try to create the separation between Annie and Lillian. And then on the other side of that with Annie, which I know we talked about how a lot of times films in this category really are ensemble pieces, and this is an ensemble, but it is centered around Annie and Annie's experiences as, you know, her best friend is getting married and what that's doing to her. And so we don't spend time in the lives of these other women. We only see them when they're all together. But with Annie, what we're seeing with her is all the things that are happening in her life in addition to, or right around at the same time as, her best friend getting married, which is that, like I said, she lost her job. She has crazy roommates and then eventually can't live with them anymore. She has a car that is run down, and all this is because she had tried to open a bakery. She's very talented and she tried to open a bakery and that didn't work out. So she lost all of her money and some other people's too. And so we're seeing all the things that are going wrong in her life so that we feel what she's feeling, as the one thing that's always been the strongest constant, her best friend. she's losing that too. And so we're feeling that experience along with her. And it just, it's all part of what just makes this such a, such a different type of, it's definitely raunchy. Yeah. You have stuff like with John Hamm, this, this sort of casual sex buddy that she's got. Even
he's
though
the worst she's human being, like, oh, he's just so horrible.
He's awful. He's the worst. But you also get some of the raunchiness in the way that the women talk to each other too. Yeah. But it's, I think what separates this really distinctly from a movie like The Hangover isn't just the types of conversations the women have, but really that this is kind of a whole package type of movie. These are fully fleshed out people that we get to spend some time with and really understand who they are and what their lives are, what they're kind of escaping from when they go to these different events and what they have to go back to when, you know, the bachelorette party is over, et cetera.
Yeah. There's, one of the things I like is, like you say, we get everything basically through Annie's perspective, most of it through Annie's perspective. And so we're very much on her side a lot of the time. She's like, yeah, life is really beating her up. But then you get these little flashes of like, but she's also really not helping herself.
Right.
Right. And you get it right from the very beginning. Like Lillian says to her, like, whenever you go out with this guy, you hate yourself. Like, why are you spending time? And she does have a choice there. She can decide not to spend time with this guy. And she's like, and I don't, you know, she's like, I don't like the fact that you hate yourself after all of this. You have to go through all this. And I like that. And you get that throughout. And you get that also with her, her kind of building relationship with Rhodes, the police officer, who says to her several times, like, why, you know, you can just get your taillights fixed.
Yeah.
You can do that. Like, it's those things that while we feel got a great deal of sympathy with Annie, we also get the sense increasingly, like, she's not, she's depressed, right? She's sad, she's struggling, but she's also not helping herself. And she's complaining about the fact that she's not helping herself. And I like that. I like that we get those little elements. And we also get those flashes of like the other women's lives. And I particularly like when it comes to Lillian, when she runs off, she disappears, right? She cannot be found. And it's, that's again, the scene they find her eventually. She's like, oh, she's in her apartment.
Missing girl found at apartment.
Hey, go rescue your friend from her apartment. But it is this like, and suddenly we get this like, oh, she's going through shit too. Like she feels like she's been abandoned. She feels like, you know, what is she even doing? Why is she getting married? You know, all of those things. Like she feels like, you know, her, she's suddenly like, my dad can't afford all of the things that is happening. Like he doesn't know what to do. So you get these moments of like, these are not, but you say these women have other lives that are not being shown on screen. But also everybody is dealing with something that is not immediately prevalent. And you're just like, oh yeah, she's having difficulty too. And she wants to have her best friend there. Mm-hmm. And that's why, you know, she asked Annie to be her matron of honor, not Helen at the beginning, right? That's the whole point. Let's talk really quickly about some of the more secondary characters. So in particular, I love all of them. One of the things that I really do wish the film had gone further on, and I feel like it's something that got cut out or something, is the relationship between Rita and Becca.
Yes. It was
Wendy McClendon Covey and Ellie Kemper, because it's heavily hinted that like they are embarking on sort of a lesbian relationship at one point. And it's just,
you mean
like,
when they start making out on a plane?
When they start making out. And there's also a scene where like it's at the bridal shower and Annie says something like lesbians, and they kind of look at each other. And I feel like it got cut. It was like in part of the script and it got cut out or it got cut down, but I really wanted more just generally of the two of them, because they're very funny women. But also, it's just like, those two women are not straight. Like, can we talk about this?
Yeah, well, let's talk about them for a second. So it's interesting because there's a lot happening there and you don't necessarily know, is it that they are actually lesbians? Are both of them bisexual? Are they just having some fun? You don't really know. And I would say you don't necessarily need to know. It is just kind of this interesting thing that I agree. I would love to have seen it get explored a little bit more, but also this is you know, I kind of always, I'm not a big, like, let's do a sequel for everything, but this is kind of one where I would love to revisit these characters and kind of catch up with them 10 years later or something, you know, but I think the setup with them is really interesting because you've got Rita, who is Wendy McClendon Covey, and she is this mom of three boys. She hates them. Obviously, she loves being a mom, but she just hates being a boy mom because she's constantly just like talking about how terrible they treat her and all the crazy, like awful crap that happens in her house. And like, oh, I cracked a blanket in half. Oh, ugh. But.
I love that the introduction of her character is like, there's so much semen. And it's just yes. Like, how is this a conversation that's happening in this moment? Like, it's like her second line. Uh-huh.
Yeah, but it's like, that's just what her life is, you know? And so she's just miserably surrounded by men. And then you've got Becca, who is a newlywed, who's married to a guy who might be gay, might be asexual. We're not really sure. He does everything he can to avoid sex with his new wife, and she's miserable. And so they end up having a scene on the plane where they're having this conversation, and Rita's basically like, yeah, it's because you never had slutty college years. You don't know what you like. And so they're kind of in this experimental thing, and how that plays out for the two of them, no, it's up to us to imagine. Nobody really knows for sure. Maybe they both leave their husbands and live together happily. But the point of that, I think, is that they are both miserable in the situations that they're currently in, and they find some comfort in each other, even though what they're going through is different. Mm-hmm. One can't get her husband to leave her alone. The other can't get her husband to touch her. But it really, it's another thing that brings them together, you know, and
Yeah. I mean, I have like, even, I don't know, maybe it's just like the approach that I was taking when I was watching film. It's just like those women are not straight. They're just not. Right. I do not believe that they are straight because one of them is obviously disgusted by men, and yes, the other one married a guy that doesn't want to be with her. Like,
right. But she wants to be wanted and all of that. Yeah. So I would say definitely Becca is a lesbian and did not know that when she got married, because she probably was a virgin when she got married. For Rita, I think it's more of just, I would say she's probably bisexual. That's my guess. That's my interpretation.
Well, and I do love, and this is why I think I wanted a little bit more of them, just to see like kind of in the background or something, like where is that dynamic going right now? Because I love that just like, you are as beautiful as Cinderella and you smell like pine needles. It's just like,
you have a face like sunshine.
Just like that, that's sort of like cute aggression or something like that. Mm-hmm. It's just very, it's very funny. And of course it's occurring on the whole airplane scene where everybody is just losing their goddamn minds. Yeah, basically
everything's melting down,
getting drunk or getting high, like, you know. And again, I think that as, and Kristen Wiig is hilarious in that whole thing, like she's wonderful, but it overshadows some of the other things that are going on.
That entire scene from the moment they get on that plane, actually from the moment they're walking up the jetway until they get kicked off the plane, is one, I would say, one of the greatest comedy scenes,
yeah,
at least of the last 20 years, I would say maybe ever.
Well,
it's so well done.
It's so well structured, like, because yeah, you know, like, you get the, okay, Annie is afraid of flying. She really doesn't like this. You get the nightmares.
And she also is bringing in the anxiety of still not being able to afford any of this.
Yeah.
So that's, it just magnifies everything.
You get the nightmare of the seating arrangements, like, you know, all the things. And then you get, and then again, everybody's getting drunker, getting high, getting like, you know, it's getting worse and worse. One of the things I really like about it is that there is this moment of like prompts, just like, oh, they're going to go to Vegas, and then they never fucking get to Vegas,
right?
And the entire, like, the whole Vegas scene is on the plane, basically. Yeah. That's where everything begins escalating. Yeah, it's very, very clever. We have other films to talk about, but let's talk about really quickly. Let's really talk about Megan, because I don't think we can't go past Bridesmaids without talking about Megan.
Oh, we cannot.
played by Melissa McCarthy as truly one of the weirdest,
characters ever to appear on screen, and she's so fucking lovable. I love her so much. She's out of her goddamn mind. I want to be friends with Megan. I want to be friends with Megan, but like slightly from a distance. Just like, Megan, tell me what happened in your week. Like, that's mm-hmm. the kind of person she is. She's fantastic. But there are scenes where you get her reality as just like, she's got security clearance. Like, she's actually this really high powered person, and just like, okay, yes, I believe that.
Yeah. Well, just going back to what you said before, one of the things this movie really is about is class. And Megan is someone who is kind of a covert agent there. Like, you find out later on that, yeah, she has this high security clearance. She also just has a lot of money. She's done very well for herself. There's the scene where she comes to confront Annie, and she's just like, yeah, I've got four houses. I have an 18-wheeler just because I can. And so she's done very well for herself, mm-hmm. but the way that she, from her outside appearance and the way she's constantly in, you know, in like braces on her wrists and her feet and whatever, and she just doesn't dress very well, or you know, she's always wearing very casual, comfortable clothes, and she never fixes herself up, and it's like, she doesn't need to. Who does she need to put on a show for? She's very unapologetically herself, but because she's so herself, it's very easy to dismiss her and totally miss all the things that she is that we never see.
Yeah, exactly. Like, I her introduction is just so shocking. And I do like the, I died.
Oh, no,
like,
shit.
I died like I just died laughing at her introduction because she's just like, oh, I've, you know, my entire body just got pins in my body. Like, I fell off a cruise ship. Just like ping ponging down. It was just like, it was intense. Like,
a lot of shit.
Holy shit. What is happening? Like, she is, and again, it's one of those, like, a lot of these women, you've met, maybe not met women this extreme before, but you've met women like them. I've met mm-hmm. people that will just say shit, just like, what life do you live? What are you, what? I didn't know human yeah. beings had those experiences. And just come out with the craziest shit. So, yeah, again, I think she's a wonderful character, and just so entertaining. And again, so many of these characters could so easily overshadow each other, but they don't. It's a really well-balanced film in a lot of ways.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And yeah, and very much about these bizarre, wonderful female relationships. Yeah. So we are going to talk about other films. Let's talk about
let's do.
I think we could keep on going with Bridesmaids, actually. But the next one we want to talk about is Joyride, which comes out, let's see, that'd be 12 years later. Yeah. Wow. Yeah. Which is very related to Bridesmaids, actually, in that it is very much about, in this case, four different women coming from a lot of different spaces, who get together to travel to China and get into many shenanigans in mm-hmm. going to China. So why don't you go on about this, Karen? Why don't you start us off? What are your thoughts on Joyride?
Yeah, I love it. It's so funny. What I like is, so in this case, instead of, you know, these being four girls that are, you know, going to a wedding or going to some sort of whatever it is, basically this starts off kind of with a lie, where you have Audrey, who's played by Ashley Park, who is, she was adopted. She was raised by white parents in America, and she does not know anything about her birth family, but she's become a very successful lawyer, and she's looking to make a big deal, and she kind of tells a lie about her family because he doesn't feel like he can go into business with her unless he knows where she came from. Family is very important and history is very important. And so she ends up kind of in this situation where she has to go try to track down her birth mom to make a good impression so that she can make this deal. And she ends up bringing her best friend and then they get joined by, yeah, so it's this group of four, kind of loosely connected in some ways. They're all connected to each other, but they're not good group, good. They're not like four best friends at the start of it. And mm-hmm. It's a lot of things. It's a road trip movie. It's a finding yourself an identity movie. It's mm-hmm. and that takes on different things for all of them, because you have these four women who all in different ways are trying to figure out who they are. And yeah. And I think that it handles those separate stories so well as they relate to each other. It's also very funny. There are some very raunchy scenes that are there's one in particular involving a men's basketball team, an NBA team, that is just like, what is happening? And also, I love every minute of this.
Well, it very much, unlike Bridesmaids, which doesn't have a lot to do with men, actually, from it really doesn't. About a wedding, it has very little to do with men. although I do love Rhodes.
Yes.
But yeah, this one has more to do with men, and definitely more to do with sex. And like, yeah. Really, these women, and it's not just about that, but like some of these women getting to express themselves sexually and have sexual experiences and have crazy ones. And again, I think that that's where, you know, when you begin to get movies like this that are actually about women, you get the female perspective on some of this, and including, so, you know, so often we hear like, oh, women don't want to have casual sex. Just like, actually, some women do. That's some women want. and they want to do it with hot basketball players. Like,
mm-hmm.
Yeah. So it like really actually goes into that and as it were, and makes it funny in a way that, you know, you would usually expect would come from male centric films. But is again very female centric and very much about female pleasure and desire and things like that. While at the same time, you know, telling this other story about the intersection of identity and particularly this whole issue about being a Chinese girl being adopted by white people, being raised by white people, and then those crises of identity that each of the different characters go through in different ways.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because you have, like we said, you have this girl who's adopted and doesn't really know where she came from. Yeah. And then you've got Lolo, which she's very much, her life has gone very much the opposite direction, where she's not the successful, you know, entrepreneur or lawyer or whatever that her parents would love her to be. And then you've got Deadeye, who is really struggling with identity, and by the end gets to embrace their identity as a non-binary yeah. person. And then you've got Stephanie Hsu, what is her character's name?
Cat, yeah. Who's just I love the trajectory of her character, because when she was introduced, I was just like, oh god, she's like the, you know, she's just, you know, the straight-laced one. Just like, holy shit, no, she is not. I was like,
no, that girl is lying to get the hot Christian guy.
And it just keeps on going. And I really do love her character, because the like seething intensity that is just underlying everything, you're just like, that girl's gonna blow up eventually. Like, what is happening?
Yeah. Yeah. But it really is this great blend of these four very different personalities mm-hmm. who all have different reasons for going on this trip. And what happens to them along the way, and the way that they grow together and separately, is one of the hallmarks of this type of film. These you know, these raunchy lady comedies, or just lady comedies in general, you know, whether you have a lot of sex in them or not, it's women are about growth and in incremental ways. And I think that this is a film that really taps into that very, very well. I want to also mention, this is directed by Adele Lim, who co-wrote Crazy Rich Asians. That's what she's, that was kind of her breakout work, was Crazy Rich Asians. And I love that she's being able to kind of forge her path in the comedy world.
Well, and when it comes to identity, and again, you know, we're talking about this as two white women, so we've not had the experiences that these women have had. But I,
right.
the contrast between between Audrey and Lolo, and the way in which, so they initially meet when they're kids, and like literally Audrey's parents are like, oh, you're the only other Asian kid.
Mm-hmm.
So you can be friends. You just
have to be best friends.
Yeah, you just have, and they do become best friends, right? And they actually, but there's this whole thing, just like, would we have been friends really if, you know, we weren't the only two Asian kids? But then there's this whole thing about, you know, that whole concept of the model minority and having to really strive to be, you have to be perfect. Mm-hmm. And that's the thing that Audrey's experiencing as this Chinese girl who is the adopted child of white people, who's growing up in a primarily white area, where the only other Asian girl is her friend. Meanwhile, Lolo, who is just kind of like very, very comfortable in who she is. Yeah. And
a little too comfortable sometimes.
And it's well, and that's the thing. There's this sense that she is more allowed to fuck up, or she allows herself to fuck up.
Yeah.
And to actually follow the things that she wants to do. Whereas Audrey feels she has to be this perfect representation of Chineseness. Yes. And then things as they go on this trip and those elements develop, and you begin to see more into, you know, the problems with both approaches, but also the fact that this is something that they have to navigate. And you know, what does it mean to actually connect to your people, your culture? What is your culture really in this sort of a situation? And it's really well done, and it's not like subtextual or anything like that. It actually like explores these issues in a very funny way, but in also a way that gives a great deal of depth to the characters.
Yeah. And in a very different way, but a similar idea to Bridesmaids, Audrey has a moment where she has to hit bottom, yeah. Where she's stranded, she's alone. The questions that she thought she was going to answer just ended up leading to more questions. She's losing everything in her life. And it's not until she gets to that point that she's able to find what she really went looking for in the first place. And it's so beautifully done. It's funny to talk about beauty in a film that includes a very raunchy orgy type of scene. but there really is just something so beautiful about Audrey's journey through this film.
You know, it's funny. You keep it. I'm like, oh, it's the orgy. That's not the image that stuck with me. There is an image in this film that I was just like, that's wow. I did not expect to see that on screen. I'm not going to spoil it for people who haven't seen it. But
does it involve an airplane hangar?
Yes, it does.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's. I was just like, whoa. Okay, that's. Yeah, it's just this moment.
A little surprising. Yeah,
it's a little surprising. So, like the orgy scene, just like that's not what stuck with me. I don't know.
No, that's one of the big funny moments, but it's not the only one. But that's the thing. It's like you have a movie with those kinds of scenes, but you also have just these really, really like emotionally rich moments too, especially for Audrey.
Yeah, and it balances those things really well, and gives space for their characters. Like you say, the character of Deadeye, mm-hmm. who I really like their trajectory, because it isn't the central, you know, point of the story, but I like that it's actually included, and that it feels very natural to everything else. It because a lot of the film really is about this like search for identity and being who you are authentically. And that doesn't mean you have to discover who your birth parents are. That doesn't mean that you have to define yourself based on a specific culture or a specific space, but to actually be the person that you are.
Right.
And their whole story feeds into that and integrates with that. And again, a character that could, you know, is very much presented initially as being kind of the big funny one, right? Mm-hmm. And rapidly becomes like, no, this is a person who is like going through their own shit.
Right. I really like Deadeye, because they are someone who when you first meet them, it's all you see is like, oh, this is the awkward cousin that we're saddled with, and is obsessed with K-pop, and that's all they care about is K-pop and talking about that. And it's, you know, and it's just kind of this weird thing. But yeah, once you kind of get to know them a little bit and get to see, there's also a lot of depth there. And
yeah,
it's all four of these ladies have depth to their characters, which is what makes this all work so well, and why it's not just this funny movie about sex.
Yeah, exactly. In fact, all three of the films that we're talking about, it takes these comedic premises and then like actually develops them and goes with them and gives like the characters, like you say, depth. Mm-hmm. Reality, like these are real people, like you say, you know, talking about Bridesmaids, that these are people that we've met, you know. Mm-hmm. You recognize them, and I think that there's a similar experience with Joyride, and also with the other film that we were going to talk about, which is Bottoms, which is kind of the odd one out, like I said earlier, and is much more like heavily satirical. Like Bridesmaids and Joyride are very much like, yes, they're extreme in a lot of ways, but they're meant to be taken as more or less reality. Bottoms is a weird film in a lot of ways, because for a little while, I'm just like, what is this high school? What is this world? I think that at some point earlier, I think we mentioned that it's more similar to like Heathers.
Yeah.
Where you get the sensation of like, this is not a real world. This isn't intended to be real in the same way that the Joyride or Bridesmaids is.
Right. Yeah. This very much is a satire, and you can really see the influences of films like Heathers all over this movie. It's not even just, oh, kind of feel like maybe they watched Heathers once and then wrote about, like, it's very clearly heavily influenced by films like that. It's also, unlike the other two, this is a high school movie. So this is very much about, even though they're all adults, this is about teenagers, and so I haven't been to a high school lately, so I don't know how teenagers relate to each other now, other than what I see, you know, on TV or on TikTok. But So I can't speak to the accuracy of this, but I do think that it really does get to the heart of some things that are just true about female friendship, and also, how do I say this?
I don't know.
I think it also really just does a good job. This is a movie that, like we keep referring to it as a satire. For anybody who hasn't seen it yet, which is probably most people, it had a pretty small release and it just came out, you know, basically a few months ago. But so I also don't really want to spoil too much of the details of this one, but because you just need to watch it.
Yeah.
But it really is, when I say it's a satire, it really does get into a lot of, you know, things that we've seen in the last few years with the Me Too movement. Mm-hmm. It gets into, you know, just how dangerous it can be to be a woman, a girl. Mm-hmm. But also us getting to take some of our power back, and how we can wield that.
There's a lot more darkness in this film. Really quickly, since I think that this is one of the least known film that we're going to talk about, and we will not spoil everything or anything like that, but the story revolves around PJ and Josie play, and I'm going to mangle her name, I'm so sorry,
Ayo Edebiri.
Okay. I never know how to pronounce the last name.
She just won the Emmy and the SAG award for the FX series The Bear. Sorry. Anyway, go on.
And Rachel Sennott, who is also one of the writers on this one, is directed by Emma Siegelman. And they're in high school. They are the unpopular lesbians in high school. And as in many high school sex comedies, what they really want is to get laid.
They want to have sex with cheerleaders, just like all boys do.
They want to have sex with cheerleaders, and so in order to have sex with cheerleaders, they decide that they're going to make a female fight club that is supposed to be for feminist self-defense and feminist empowerment. But the whole point is that they get to hit and also be on top of girls, and particularly they want to, they have specific women that they're actually attracted to.
They get to roll around in the gym with girls is what they get to do, and it's school sanctioned because they have to get a faculty member to be the advisor for their club.
Played by Marshawn Lynch, who is fun.
He needs to be in more movies. He's so good.
He is having such a good time. Mr. G, who is their faculty advisor, and is like, and gets involved too.
And he's like, going through it too.
He's just, yeah, he's just like, I'm going to be involved with this. This is important. And so, and then things kind
good
of
allies.
Things kind of spiral outward from there.
They're able to get this going, though, is also because there's this looming threat of this rival high school, and girls are in danger, and someone might have died last year. Who knows?
It's like all of those high school movie tropes that are kind of dialed up to a degree of like, oh yeah, we're actually going to kill people. It's that kind of thing, and it is very funny, and it's. I think that that's one of the things that's a little bit difficult to understand initially about the film is getting into that, being like, okay, this is not serious,
right?
It's serious, but it's not serious. Like, no, there is no high school where they're going to murder each other over a football game or anything. It's very much treated with that edge of satire.
Yes.
And so, yeah. So as the film goes on, it gets crazier and crazier in a lot of ways, and then very much does highlight the particularly the friendship between PJ and Josie, but also a number of the other women. And it was interesting, so I remember when the story of this film came out before the film was even released, and I remember, this is back when I was still on Twitter, I remember people freaking out about it. I remember there being like, well, but if this was about boys, everybody would be angry. It's just like, yeah, that might be the point. Like, you know, it's just like, is it okay to make a fight club so that you can roll around in the gym with women? No, that's not okay. But I think that we also have to talk about, you know, the difference in dynamics when you're talking about women with women, when you're not talking about, you know, this, you're not talking about a Revenge of the Nerds, right? And right. And I do think that that the film handles that element really well. As well as getting to kind of develop the undoubted bloodlust of high school girls. And one of the things I really liked about this was just like, yes, if I had been in high school, someone was like, you want to be in a female fight club? Yes, I do. I want to beat the shit out of some people. It's just that experience of like, there's all of this intensity going on. And you just say, yeah, let's just punch each other. That would be great. And I think that people get shocked when we actually depict women as wanting that.
Yes, yes. Thank you for saying that, because, like, I remember this is several years ago. I was in a situation and I was talking to a friend, a male friend, and I was talking about something that had happened with a woman, and that she was just really driving me nuts, and I was just like, she just wouldn't shut up. I wanted to punch her in the throat. And my friend that I was telling this story to just looks at me like I was crazy. And he's just like, that's really violent. I never knew you were so violent. And I'm like, well, I didn't actually punch her in the throat. I just wanted to. And I know you have too, I'm sure. So many conversations where, you know, you hear things like, well, women don't think that way. Women don't want that. And it's like, but I'm a woman and I want that. And I do think that way. Like, what are you saying about me? You know, yeah,
but I think that some of it is because it really is not represented a great deal in media.
Exactly.
And there is this, like, so there, you know, it's those stereotypes, just like men are violent and they're like, you know, they want to fight each other, and women are gentle and all this. It's just like, no, we're not.
Sometimes we want to beat the shit out of stuff.
I will tell you right now, I have several friends who are female rugby players, and they have talked about the fact that female rugby is meaner than male rugby. They are more violent. It's like, actually, I would be terrified.
Watch roller derby sometime. Yeah,
exactly. Like, these are not, this is not gentleness. But yeah, I think that a lot of media really does want to depict women. You know, women don't swear, women aren't raunchy, women don't laugh at, you know, people having horrible food poisoning and shitting in the street.
Women don't like poop jokes.
Yeah, exactly. All of those things. And I think that, like, it's, is this like a 100%, you know, represent the female experience? No, but, you know, like, yeah, there is something really satisfying about watching a film where you're just like, yeah, beat the shit out of her. Mm-hmm. And that's why, you know, we've talked about films like Birds of Prey, which are very satisfying films for exactly that reason. Yeah. You're watching these women actually, it's not just empowerment, but it's just like, no, I have bloodlust too.
Exactly. And I think that that's one of the things that Bottoms really does kind of satisfy is, obviously a fight club could never exist in a high school, not in America anyway. There's too many laws and school boards, but the idea, because this is so such a highly fictionalized but also just very I can't think of another word besides satirical, but because of the fact that this is, everything is really amplified in Bottoms.
Campy. It's very campy.
Campy. Yes. Campy. Exactly. This is a movie that is campy is exactly the right word for it. And so it gets to play with that. It gets to play with that idea and kind of let girls know it's okay to want to beat the shit out of stuff. It's normal. We all want that. I appreciate that.
Yeah, and films like this do, like, I think, kind of give vent to that, in a safe way. So it's like, so no, we're not going to go around. I'm actually going to punch her in the throat. It's just like, yeah, but I want to. I'm not going to, but I want to.
Yeah, and saying that out loud does not make me a violent person.
Yeah, exactly. It, yeah. So I think in particular, this film really does develop those elements again, and doing it in a safe space. So within these female friendships, within like these interactions where these women, like, you know, a safe, I don't, not a safe space, like a safe way of expressing these desires.
Yes.
So any other thoughts about Bottoms? I will say that this film is actually directly related to Bridesmaids in that Megan, one of her suggestions for the bachelorette party is to just show up and beat the shit out of Lillian in a female fight club.
She shows up, we grease up, we beat the shit out of her.
Just really just pound her.
I feel like if Megan were a high school teacher, she would absolutely be the advisor for this club.
She would be into it. She would just be like, so we're thinking female fight club, great idea. Go with it. I want to be involved.
Honestly, you know what would have been great is if she had been the like the high school principal or something.
Yeah, that would have been fun. But
but Marshawn Lynch is awesome. I love him.
Yeah, he has a great time. I do like I do really like what the film then, you know, directly addresses things like feminism and the Me Too movement and this whole idea of female empowerment and the actual complexities of that. You know, is this female empowerment? Well, no, it's not. But also it kind of is. Right. And it definitely, like, advances their development and allows them to get some very satisfying revenge as well.
And also how women can be just as guilty of using things like feminism for their exactly. own purposes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. To kind of navigate the terminology, everything. It's just like, we're going to present this in a particular way as though it's feminist when really the goal is to lie on top of other women.
Yes.
So any other thoughts on Bottoms or indeed any of these films?
Well, I love them all. They're all great. I forgot to look ahead of time, but I was just going to mention where to watch them because I think they're all available for streaming. Bottoms, I believe, is on, is it Hulu?
Bottoms has been on Hulu. I believe the Joyride is as well.
I apologize. Bottoms is on Prime Video. So, Joyride is on Stars currently, and yeah, so I would if you haven't watched either of those two, I assume most people listening have seen Bridesmaids, and if they haven't by now, they probably don't want to and they should change their minds about that, but But yeah, the for Bottoms and Joyride, if you have not seen either of those yet, definitely do yourself that favor and do it. Bridesmaids is also available on Prime Video.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Or at my house. You can just come over and watch it.
Or apparently at my parents' house, they have my DVD. And to not realize that they did, but I'm glad to know that it's somewhere.
At least it's not lost.
I was so sad. I was like, I can't find it. I know that I own this film. These are fantastic films, and I do think like a good opportunity to just watch women being women.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I think that's going to close us out for this week. Thank you so much for listening. And as always, we want to thank our wonderful patrons who include Abby, Ollie, Brian, Connor, Estefania, Heather, James, Judy, Karen, Carriata, Matt, Michelle, Monty, Nanina, Robert, Steve, Sharon, and Pau. Thank you again for supporting us. If anyone has not received their buttons or stickers, please let me know. They have all been sent out. So any new ones have been sent out. If you still haven't received them, send us a message. It's possible that they got lost in the mail or something like that, and I'll send out new ones. And if you'd like to join their number, we are on Patreon, patreon.com/citizendame, where you can get all those fun buttons and stickers, as well as bonus episodes and early episodes. And also just know that you're supporting us and keep helping us keep the lights on and talking about raunchy lady comedies. So please go to our Patreon. We also have an Etsy store. That's etsy.com/shop/citizendamepod and a Ko-Fi, ko-fi.com/citizendame. And of course, there are many different ways to find our stuff. We have our website, citizendamepod.com, and you can email us, citizendamepod@gmail.com. We are also on many different socials, on all of the various socials at Citizen Dame Pod. And we are on Letterboxd at Citizen Dame, which is where you can find links to all of our old episodes, articles, and everything else. And of course, lists and everything else that we want to talk about. And of course, you can get in touch with us individually. Karen, where are you?
I am on all the socials, but specifically, most especially, Instagram and Letterboxd at Karen M. Peterson.
And I am on Instagram and Letterboxd at LH Business. So that will close us out for this week. Thank you so much for listening.
Bye.
And this is Dougie's sister, Megan.
Hey.
Hi.
Oh.
Hi. My grandma's not supposed to have wine. I'll be right back.
Hey.
How's it going?
It's going great. It's going great. I'm on the mend. You know, I just got some pins in my legs. Oh. Believe it or not, pins in my legs. Can still do this. All right? A mate fell off a cruise ship.
Oh,
but I'm back.
Shit.
Yeah, oh shit. Took a hard, hard, violent fall. Kind of pinballed down. Hit a lot of railings. Broke a lot of shit. I'm not going to say I survived. I'm going to say I thrived. I met a dolphin down there. And I swear to God, that dolphin looked not at me, but into my soul, into my goddamn soul, Annie, and said, I'm saving you, Megan. Not with his mouth, but he said it, I'm assuming telepathically. We had a connection that I don't even know if I can, oh, Jesus. Hey, shut my mouth. Look at, unbelievable. You must be Annie's fella. I'm Megan. It's a pleasure.
Oh, well. I'm not with him. Sorry.
Oh, all right. I'm glad he's single because I'm going to climb that like a tree.